Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day. And today, I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. I'm completely and utterly surrounded by my stuff, and my Grognard Files are in here somewhere. It's worse than ever here in my den. It is piled high with tins of soup, various meats, pouches of rice, and pot noodles by the ton. Don't worry, I'm not becoming some kind of prepper. No, my son is about to leave for university, and the den has become a storeroom until we're ready to make the great journey. On my right, somewhere over here, is the great library of RPGs and my Grognard Files, and somewhere on my left, I can't quite find it in this mess and disarray, is the ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. You'll just have to imagine it and make up your own appearance this time. I'll be glad when it's all gone. The den feels like a bunker, and it's kind of fitting because our guest this time is Malcolm Craig. Malcolm is a games designer of Hot War, Cold City, two games, have been recently reissued as brand new editions. They look beautiful as well. Have a look in the show notes to see more of that. But he's also an academic who's studying the relationship between post-apocalyptic RPGs and the Cold War in the 1980s. But I invited him on because I wanted to talk to him about West End Games' 1986 game, The Price of Freedom. If you were in the UK at the time, you probably knew the game more by its reputation than actually playing it, because in the pages of White Dwarf, it created quite a controversy. Now, I've subsequently played Price of Freedom, and we played it using the characters from The Breakfast Club, The Price of Breakfast, no less, where our detention was interrupted by the need to corral our neighbourhood to resist the invading commies. All good fun. Also in this episode, I'm joined in the room of role-playing rambling by Blythe, our resident rules lawyer. Now, we were going to do something a bit different. We're going to actually look at the film Red Dawn, but we decided instead to do RPG a day. I'll be back at the end with some parish notices and to welcome some new patrons that have joined us over the last few months. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Open Box.
Okay, welcome to Open Box, the part of the podcast where we look backwards to look forwards. How our gaming of the past informs the gamers that we are today. I'm in the Zoom of role-playing rambling with academic and game designer Malcolm Craig. Hello there, Malcolm.
Hello, thank you very much for having me on. It's really great to be invited on to talk about my idiosyncratic interest.
We've recently been playing together, haven't we? We met up in Bradford for Rolling in the Ruins, and you ran a game for me.
Yeah, it was a game of second edition Hot War. First time I'd run a game at a convention since Jesus was in short trousers. And I hardly ever run games anymore at all. I've fallen out of actually playing games. So it was kind of a terrifying experience, especially with the array of talent and seasoned gamers and YouTubers and podcasters and everything around the table. It was slightly intimidating.
Well, you did very well, but we can perhaps talk about the game. But you said that you've not really been gaming recently. So how did you start, and what were the kind of games you were playing back in the day?
Oh, so back in, I mean, obviously, I think for so many people in the UK, I have the same story, like fighting fantasy. That was the entree into the entire hobby. So there's that, the little introductory role-playing game book, the tiger person bursting out of the dice and everything. And then Maelstrom, kind of like Elizabethan England kind of book and everything. And I bought that thinking it was like a fighting fantasy book. I was like, wait, you need other people to play this. And then a friend of mine asked if I wanted to actually play a role-playing game. And the first game we actually played was Call of Cthulhu. The game, there were eight people there. The game lasted 45 minutes. There was several arguments and half of the people walked out. And I thought that's what role-playing was. I was like, oh, that was interesting. So then someone said, oh, we'll play Twilight 2000 now to fill up the rest of the evening. And the rest is basically history. So my first proper role-playing game was Twilight 2000, which probably explains an awful lot about me.
Yeah, so that's truly how our gaming of the past informs the gamers that we are today.
Without a doubt.
So what was it about Twilight 2000 that captured your imagination?
I don't think, so I again, this is the fallibility of memory. So my friend who was running the game was very interested in military equipment and guns and all that kind of thing. And I think Twilight 2000 was an excuse for us, play a modern era game, you could be tough guy soldiers going about Poland shooting things up. And that's my memory of what playing Twilight 2000 was. I don't think we were kids, teenager, mid-teens. I don't think we were very sophisticated in our approach to it. It was like, can we get a tank? Right, now we have a tank. How many machine guns did we have? All that kind of thing. So I don't think we were sophisticated. We just certainly didn't approach it with any degree of nuance. It was, you know, it was basically watching things like Commando and Predator and Full Metal Jacket and all these kind of things and translating it to the gaming table. But that was, I mean, it was a formative experience for me, like playing Twilight 2000. And we always tended to play modern era or like contemporary or science fiction games. We never really went into the fantasy direction. And I think in part that was dictated by, you know, initially playing Twilight. He says with the hazy memories of all of this.
There was a cluster of militaristic role-playing games that seemed to come out around the same time, didn't they? Mid-80s. And perhaps go on to talk about
some, yeah.
We should say that, you know, part of your academic interest, you've been doing some work, haven't you, in this very area, in the world of role-playing games.
Yeah, and I'm still kind of like wondering how I'm being allowed to do it. So I am currently writing a book about the intersections between role-playing games and the Cold War. And initially, mostly focusing on the kind of the way that role-playing games co-opted ideas of nuclear fear and the apocalypse and everything that was in the air in the 1970s and then especially in the 1980s. So you have these games that are militaristic, that are post-apocalyptic, that draw in all these Cold War fears. So my research project is looking, examining that, because a lot of stuff has been written about the history of role-playing games from the perspective, like the evolution of D&D, for example, has been covered extensively. John Peterson has done amazing work on that, but no one's really examined the Cold War influence on role-playing games, and that's what I'm really interested in.
Yeah, and part of it, if I'm right, part of your research has been doing some oral history, hasn't it, and speaking to gamers about experiences.
That's been amazing. It's been the best part of the project. People have been so generous with their time. And so enthusiastic and willing to talk about their lives in gaming. You're interested in kind of how people get to where they are in gaming now as well. And it is absolutely fascinating to listen to people reminiscing about whether they played Gamma World or Twilight 2000 or Paranoia or, you know, Aftermath, Moral Project, all of these other games, you know, talking about why they played them, how they played them, you know, did it mean anything to them? Were they just like me? And it's just like an excuse for, you know, you're a teenager, you could have a macho guy running about with M60 and all that kind of thing. Or were they actually considering it within the framework of, nuclear bombs could drop at any moment now. Does that actually impact on people's experience of gaming? And it's been the stories that people have, you know, the stuff they relate to me as part of these interviews has just been fantastic and brought out so much stuff that I would never have cottoned on to had I not done those, like, I think it's 45 oral history interviews with people who were gaming in the kind of late 70s into the 90s, up to 1991, really, so end of the Cold War, obviously. So without that, there's so much stuff I would not have known, because, you know, it's that thing of like, you can write as much as you want about games, but games are meant to be played. And you can't understand the games without understanding how people played them and what their experiences were. So It's been great. It's been absolutely lovely. And some fascinating snippets and amazing stories that have come out of it. It's been absolutely great.
And as part of that, was that an international group of people or were it mainly UK-based?
Transatlantic. United States. So I'm concentrating on the kind of the gaming cultures in the United States and the United Kingdom. Because I think, well, on one hand, that's where my personal experience lies. So I think I can relate to that a little bit better and have a better insight into, you know, what was going on, having been part of that, kind of almost like that participant observer kind of thing. Also, I would do a complete disservice to the gaming cultures in, you know, France, Germany, Belgium, Norway, Sweden, because of my lack of facility with almost all of those languages, bar German. And I don't think it's my place to look at those. I think it's better suited for, you know, for other people, you know, around the world. You know, there's people doing amazing stuff on the role-playing culture in Brazil and stuff like that. So, you know, amazing things, or like different parts of the world. It's not my place to investigate that. So I'm looking at the kind of transatlantic perspective on it. And, you know, in many ways that makes it, you know, a wee bit easier. The commonality of language, all of that kind of thing. So, yeah, so people in the US, a smattering of people in Canada, and people in the UK.
And I'm curious about the people, you know, when people interact with these games in the US, is their experience different? Because they tend to interact more with the military, don't they? So it's like part of people's lives a lot more than maybe it is in the UK.
Yeah. One absolutely standout thing that emerges from doing these interviews is the influence of Vietnam. And the conflict in Vietnam on the way that many people experience these games. So games like Twilight 2000, I interviewed a whole bunch of people whose games were GM'd by Vietnam veterans. Mm-hmm. Who, you know, they were kind of like, you know, the players were teenagers at the time, but there was a slightly older man, you know, as we're all familiar with, you know, we were always like, I mean, the teenagers going into games shop, there's always the older guys who, I played D&D first in 1974, and all that, and now we're those guys. So having GMs with the military experience of the conflict in Vietnam, and also just the saturation of American politics and culture with the fallout from Vietnam, is not something we had over here. So that, how much of an influence of Vietnam on playing these games in the US was. Over here, the kind of the bleed through of that was very, very different because we didn't have that direct experience. But what was interesting is that many people talked about how their games of things like Twilight 2000 were influenced by watching films like Full Metal Jacket, Hamburger Hill, Platoon, Apocalypse Now, and how people were translating stuff like Apocalypse Now into post-apocalyptic Poland. So Vietnam had this almost third-hand influence on British gaming culture at the time, as opposed to the much more direct influence that it had in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess I seem to remember being a child in the 70s and there was still like a nostalgia for the Second World War, and it was there in the culture that we were part of, but it didn't have an immediacy. And you know, playing with friends in the US, everybody seems that they part of the military, or they have friends or a family who are now part of the military, or, you know, it is, whether it's in procurement or active service. Whereas we just don't have that sense, do we? You know, it's like that distance.
And it was interesting also that I interviewed a couple of people from the UK who had joined the forces over here. But there were many more people in the US that I interviewed who had either been active service personnel or who had parents who were in the military. And so they grew up near air bases and army bases and all that kind of thing. And that was a kind of like a second-hand experience or first-hand experience. I'm not second-hand, what am I saying? So yeah, there was much more of a kind of like, you know, military cultural dimension to the American experience. And I'm speaking in very general terms.
Yes,
here.
Absolutely.
You know, it's a very broad brush. But all of this came out of the interviews and it's like fascinating stuff.
When we were in Bradford, we were talking at lunchtime in the amazing Waterstones that they have there.
What an amazing building.
Yeah. So the Waterstones in Bradford is in the old Wool Exchange.
Yeah.
And it's a fabulous place. Yeah.
It's an amazing bookshop. You go inside and it's just this incredible architecture.
Yeah. And so we were having a chat over lunch about White Dwarf letters page, and that was a sort of battleground, wasn't it, for some of the ideas. And you said, I really must do something about that. And I thought straight away, I've got to get Malcolm on to talk about the letters page in White Dwarf.
There were so many. I mean, you look back at it. So I was lucky enough that the Tim Bellawley, who's the archivist at Games Workshop, he very kindly gave me access to text searchable PDFs of the first 100 issues of White Dwarf for research purposes. Not allowed to share them. People have asked, I promised them no. But Games Workshop, I know people give them a bad rap at times, but they've been very helpful and very generous with my research. And it's fascinating going, I mean, I remember some of them from about the late 70s issues of White Dwarf onwards when I started reading it. But I'm sure we'll get on to the ones we were thinking about by now. But there were so many like raging arguments about completely inconsequential talk. I mean, okay, you get that on like Discord threads and forums and everything these days. But the one that sticks in my mind, other than the ones about the games that I'm researching, is the one about the probabilities of like half elf interbreeding, producing an elf or a half elf or a human and everything. And it descended into people referring to books about budgerigar breeding and how to breed different colours and using that for the genetic probabilities. I just remember the time, what on earth? You know, and I mean, that was the silly stuff, but there was also the long running arguments about like gender in gaming. And there was, you know, a lot of people would put their names to, you know, nowadays it's all kind of, you know, Slaglord 47. You never know who it is. It's on, you know, on a Discord forum. But then it was like, you know, Jeff Scruggins of Ipswich says women should not be allowed in role-playing games. And like, Jeff, come on. You know? And I think there's a kind of intentionality behind like writing a letter, having your address on it, putting your name on it, stamping it, posting it, and sending it off to a magazine that is radically different to just posting something on an internet forum in a knee-jerk kind of way. But that one about gender and gaming, and it was utterly just reading them back again. You just look at, you just say, what were you thinking about?
Yeah. You know, I think you can definitely track as well if you follow the letters page, that there was an injection of the fanzine spirit that happened with the introduction of Ian Marsh and Mark Gascoigne.
Yes.
They brought some of that sensibility of that kind of, I suppose, like an inner world of role-playing games where people kind of sniped at each other.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it did, yeah. It's been amazing going back over it.
and the topic that we were mentioning is furore over the Price of Freedom when that was released. So do you want to explain what actually happened with that?
Right. So I think it's one of the famous kind of moments in White Dwarf in the 1980s. So the game designer, Greg Costigan, in 1986, he had published through West End Games a game called Price of Freedom. And Price of Freedom was in many ways the kind of like the film Red Dawn, the Soviets have invaded and a plucky band of Americans just take to the hills to fight the Soviet invaders. And Price of Freedom is very gung-ho in this regard. It was peppered with, you know, ultra-patriotic, ultra-conservative slogans in it. It was even had things like a note to liberal leaders. And it was very gung-ho, yeah, USA, USA, all that kind of stuff. I mean, but Costigan's a clever, you know, very clever guy and a very, very good game designer. And of course, it was a satire. It wasn't meant to be taken entirely seriously, but it was done so straight-faced that this caused an absolute furore on this side of the Atlantic because people weren't quite sure. I mean, I think they kind of might have got the joke if they looked at the section on guerrilla warfare and all the quotes in it are from Che Guevara and Mao Zedong. Okay. And all the other little bits peppered through it, you know, like in the list of things that the Soviets are coming to take away, you know, your VCR comes before your family and all these kind of things. You know, it's just, you know, it was intended as satire, but, you know, I think because it emerged into that kind of like mid to late Reagan period, you know, the Cold War wasn't quite winding down at this point. There'd been a lot of kind of aggressive rhetoric, you know, from Reagan in his first term. That I think there's, you know, people were a bit, and this created an absolute, well, a mini firestorm on the pages of White Dwarf, which had been, I mean, so the interesting thing, it had been preceded by a similar, like, outbreak of anger about Twilight 2000, just about a year and a half previously. And that centered in this debate about, you know, like, is it well, on one hand, is it moral and ethical to play games about nuclear war? And the other one was about the nature of the review, because it was reviewed by Marcus Vowland, you know, legendary figure in British gaming circles. And he was, you know, he absolutely put the boots to Twilight 2000. Like, it's immoral, you know, it's typically typically American, and I'm doing air quotes now for listeners, typically American, all these kinds of, he hated it. And there was this tinge of anti-Americanism came out, which was, you know, kind of a thread in a lot of British gaming discussions at the time. So the Price of Freedom thing came hard on the heels of a kind of pre-existing debate about, you know, the ethics of games like this, and is it just, you know, Americans wanting to blow up the world? And I'm doing so many air quotes here, just assume everything's in air quotes.
Yeah, you just have to assume that there's air quotes around these.
Yeah, yeah.
What struck me about rereading it is that it actually only takes place over three or four issues, but in my memory, it seemed to go on forever.
Yes. Yeah. But it's some of the attacks on it were like, so I love some of the lines in it, you know, because Games Workshop were the distributors of West End games in the UK, which, you know, obviously there's a bit of a conflict of interest there. And some of the lines are great. So one reader said, "What are you doing distributing such jingoistic nonsense as The Price of Freedom? If the Americans want to play it commie bashing, then let them. But I, for one, am sick of Reaganism." And he's like, well, there's, you know, no mincing words there. And so, someone else described it as nothing more than neo-fascist, anti-socialist paranoia. If America's the only alternative, then I'd be more than willing to be overrun by the Soviet Union. Just, I mean, some of this, and also the other, and this is, I think, going a bit over the top, that Price of Freedom would lend itself, quote, to the justification of all manner of repression, torture and massacre in the real world by effectively branding anyone who might come within a certain range of political views as subhuman. You know, discourse is going to discourse. But it was vitriolic at times.
It's curious, isn't it, that it was released by Custician around the same time as Paranoia. Over here, I think it was reviewed in the same issue.
Contemporaneous, yeah.
And they're on a continuum, aren't they? Because he's exploring similar themes, but in a bit more of a knockabout way in Paranoia.
Paranoia is one of the best designed games of the 1980s. I think it's genuinely great. I mean, you know, Costigan, you know, Ralston, Gelber. It's a genuinely great piece of work and very, very clever in what it does. And you're right. I mean, both are kind of exploring kind of themes of the Cold War. You know, Paranoia is the kind of like, haha, we actually survived a nuclear war. Then it went all wrong because we had nuclear weapons in museums and it all kind of like everything kicked off. And it's this kind of like anarchic, I'm trying to think how I would, you know, describe it. It's like, you know, Marx Brothers plus, you know, Mad Magazine plus 1984 plus a Sam Peckinpah movie, where everyone gets a go with a machine gun and just, you know, everyone's dying. And I think, Paranoia is definitely exploring those themes as well. Whereas, you know, Price of Freedom was doing that, but it was misunderstood. I think if people, you know, we've both read it within recent memory. If you read it, you get the joke.
Yes.
It
is played with a straight face, isn't it? And reading it now, I feel a bit differently because it's a bit different than I remembered, actually, because it's not particularly about America occupied, is it? It's that they're being cowed by the strength of the Soviets. So there's a quisling president in charge and the invasion is slowly starting. So, you know, you might start with Bon Jovi. Your campaign may still have Bon Jovi in it, but by the end of it, it's a Bon Joviet, Comrade Bon Joviet.
Yes.
it's quite clever in its the way that it's framed, that actually it's a pernicious taking over, whereas usually these games are very resolute, aren't they? They're the point that there's some period after an occupation or some period after a bomber's been dropped. But this is, you're in the thick of it when this is actually occurring. Mm.
And that, I mean, that's a kind of fantasy that's been part of American politics and culture since the founding of the Republic. These fantasies have always been around. You know, in the 1790s, they were kind of terrified. Many politicians in the post-revolutionary period are terrified that Britain's going to launch a surprise attack and come back and we're going to your colonies again now. And then that continued about whether it's subversion from within. So you see the rise of groups like the Anti-Masonic Party, who were pretty successful in certain polls. And all these panning, you get into the Red Scare and everything. And you have books from the 1880s, Henry Grattan Donnelly's Stricken Nation, which is all about the US subverted and invaded. And you get into the Cold War, you have Heinlein, who wrote Oliver Lang's book Vandenberg in the 1970s. So there's this entire culture of this kind of thing in the air. But, we have it over here as well, just in a different form. Britain's persistently concerned about invasion and all that kind of thing. I mean, it takes us back to Bowling in the Ruins. Michael Moorcock was a great enthusiast for that kind of invasion literature of the kind of late Victorian Edwardian period. And you have these, in the UK, you have the same paranoid kind of fantasies about subversion. You have groups in the 70s, GB75, NAF. What were they called? Citizen Assistance? All these kind of, paranoid, oh my God, the compromise are going to take over kind of thing. So it is, and I think it's a genuine, Costigan always has something really clever and interesting within his games designs.
It is a game that is putting the player characters with their core activities, resistance. Mm. And so it gives you really good, solid advice on how to build scenarios, adventures around resistance campaigns. So building up propaganda, bringing people on side to your cause, developing pockets of networks and weapon supplies. It's all very clever.
Chapter as well about how to fight a guerrilla war. It's peppered with Mao Zedong and Che Guevara, but there's a lot, and even within the mechanics as well, there's some very clever, sly little touches within the mechanics that I think should have given the game away to a lot of people.
Antagonists here are commies, but they could be anything. And he's right, isn't he? Because throughout literature and through game, we sublimate it, don't we, with different enemies, whether it's Nazis or zombies. And it's just a humanity's resistance against a common enemy.
Yeah, and it was that kind of, that was Ponyo, goes back to this kind of the debate in White Dwarf. I can't remember, Costigan wrote a letter to White Dwarf, and I don't know if he made this point or it was another respondent. And I'm paraphrasing heavily here. So you're okay with slaughtering masses of orcs. They're fine because they're not real. But Soviet soldiers, because they kind of represent real people, you're okay with the killing. It's just who you're killing is the bit that's getting you up in arms about it. So there's something interesting in there. And a sort of side quest from this is that at roughly the same time, Task Force Games brought out Delta Force, which is your real-world special forces. Yeah, go out there. And it was entirely serious. It was an entirely serious game of playing special forces soldiers going out and killing enemies of the West and freedom and civilization. You didn't have to play Delta Force. You pay the SAS and all these kind of things. And that, in a minor way, was brought into the price of freedom furore. People also pointed at that. I went, ooh, look, Americans, kind of just this essentializing of an entire nation into one or two role-playing games.
One of the things I want to point out as well, that in the advice to Games Masters, it goes to great pains of setting the framework for the session and getting people in the right mindset, which is really quite a modern approach, isn't it? It's something that we're used to now in terms of story gaming. But he kind of sets out some methods of making sure that everybody's on the same page to make sure that it can be uncomfortable, this that you're dealing with. However, if you set it up right, you can do it effectively.
And I mean, I do wonder, I know that the reaction would have been different if you had exactly the same game, same mechanics, same text, maybe just change the contextual markers a little bit and make it about brave home guard fighting against the Nazi invasion of the UK during World War II. And I don't think anywhere, people would have gone, yay, we can play Captain Mannering and everything, we're shooting Nazis. And you can have exactly the same game. But because of the political and cultural context of it, it just flipped a switch somewhere.
It's because we're looking back on it, aren't we? And I suppose, as you're right, at that point, is that the point where the kind of brinkmanship is in full sway, where Reagan is pushing the boundaries?
Well, the irony is that this is the Cold War is starting to thaw. Because, it's March 1985 when Mikhail Gorbachev comes to power in the Soviet Union. And he's already been identified as Margaret Thatcher, actually. It was one of the Western leaders who looked at Gorbachev when he was a high official and said, this is someone we can work with if he gets into a position of serious power. And Gorbachev is already being much more conciliatory. And, first term Reagan and second term Reagan are quite different. He's still quite hawkish, but he's a lot more conciliatory and a lot more open to working with the Soviets, and particularly with Gorbachev. So it's ironic that games like, Price of Freedom, Freedom Fighters, Year of the Phoenix, and even Twilight 2000 to a certain extent, emerged at the point where all the fears that they subsist on are going to be dissipating in a few years. I mean, nobody could have seen it coming. But, because the Cold War ends, in a relative flash in 1989, nobody saw it coming. But, it's interesting that these games emerged into that moment where everything that underpins them is just going to be swept away.
And this area is a backdrop for the games that you've designed. So Hot War, Cold City.
Indeed.
About to publish the second edition.
Yes, they're going to be coming out soon. And it's my fascination with the Cold War as a whole, as a historical period, as an idea. That's why I wrote these games. These are the second editions. They were kind of written Cold City was 2006, Hot War was 2008. And these are kind of radically reimagined versions of them. All that was good about them is kept, but, with, two decades more knowledge and experience, I think I can make them a lot better, have made them a lot better than they were. But it's all my pet fascinations about the Cold War, about underground spaces, about the paranoia and alienation of the entire period. And also, morbidly interested in nuclear war. It's kind of a horrible thing to be interested in. But I'm giving my bookshelves here. There's this shelves of books just to do with nuclear warfare.
Well, I think I said to you that my awareness of Hot War, Cold City mainly came from the UK's premier podcast, which is, of course, What Were the Smart Party In? Gaz, over the years, has said what wonderful games they are.
Yeah.
And I must admit that it wasn't what I was expecting. So if people are not aware of the games, how would you pitch them? Because I wasn't aware that it's kind of an alt history involved. Which I thought was really good.
So what were you expecting? If I can flip that question back at you.
I thought it was more set in an authentic kind of history. And I wasn't ready for the Quatermass elements of it. Those genres that it kind of bleeds into, and you can pick how you want to frame it. So I really like that element of it. And I thought it was a bit more solidly set in the real world.
Right. So Cold City, just for people that don't know, and I shouldn't expect people to know these names, Cold City is set in Berlin in 1950, and you played as part of this kind of multinational organization made up of the occupying powers who are hunting down the horrors that have been unleashed by the war, either by experimentation or because of the way that the pain and suffering of war has opened time and space up in a way. And then Hot War is a follow-on for that. It diverges in 1962 when the Cuban Missile Crisis goes hot, but there are also other weapons that are used that are perhaps more Quatermass, kind of slightly occultish, supernatural, all that kind of thing. The reason for that decision of not making them as wholly grounded in our world is because I would just find that too depressing. Berlin in 1950 and the kind of the fear and paranoia of the Cold War, it's not a very cheery subject for a game. And setting a game in like post-apocalyptic London, where the British government has turned to fascism and is putting people in camps in irradiated areas and sending other people out to the turnip fields. Oh, like, that'd be like so cheerless and grim. So I don't want it to be Threads, you know, the 1984 film, which, you know, scarred generations of people in the UK. That's too grim for me. I love Threads. I think it's a great piece of art, but I don't want to play that game. So part of it was almost to have, you know, the alternative history / slightly occult supernatural stuff allows you just to, if you want, step back a little from the very real horror of nuclear warfare and the legacies of Nazism and all of these kind of things that are embedded in the game. And you can play it, I mean, the thing is, you can play it in kind of like slightly different way. One of the things I was proud of in the first editions of the game, which has been kept, is like you as a group decide the tone you want to play in, you know, whether it's quality BBC drama, art house, pulp. You could play it in a kind of two-fisted kind of way, for Cold City, not so much for Hot War. My default setting is like the Quatermass kind of thing, because I love Nigel Neal's stuff. His work is a huge influence on Cold City and Hot War, and the Quatermass programs and films, you know, I just watch them on repeat effectively.
Yeah, I like that element of it. So you, as when you're running the game, so you have a games master, don't you? Yeah, the games master, as you say, through a series of questions, kind of builds up the framework of the session that you're about to have.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you build up the games master resources, which then it's like a competition then, isn't it? A point of conflict in the drama.
Yeah. And that changed a lot from first to second edition, because the first editions were very traditional in their approach to the GM, put a lot of weight and a lot of burden on the GM. You have to kind of create NPCs, you have to stat things, and you have to, I was like, and I'm too old and lazy now to be bothered. I thought, I cannot be bothered. So now it's just the GM has five groups of dice which are assigned at the start of the game. You use those groups of dice in opposition to the players, and when some of them are done, that's that bit of the game over. You know, you reset, you go back, and you can carry on for a number of acts and how many sessions you want to play and all that kind of thing. But it's my fundamental laziness. I can't be bothered creating NPCs in advance. So, and this makes it so much easier. You just have a name. I go like, oh, yes. Oh, well, okay, you're meeting Mrs. Mythemroid, who has a dark secret. You know, like, oh, she also has three eyes. But no, that kind of thing. So it's because of my inherent laziness in late middle age.
Yeah, and I think because the players got the input initially, I suppose you don't really know which direction it's going to go, but we were creating antagonists, didn't we? Like a opera who we didn't particularly respect or like was part of it. And we had Michael Moorcock because it was a Moorcock-themed event.
Yes, yes.
As an anarchist and agent provocateur in the... But I really liked how that played out, and we came away with like a bit of a very satisfying narrative. Well, I was looking back on it, trying to work out how we managed to weave that together, but the dice do a lot of the work, don't they?
Yeah.
As well.
And it's like, it's just using the dice to kind of like, okay, there's a flashpoint here. None of us know what direction it's going in, and using that and the outcomes of that and the consequences and the way the characters change. And as, you know, the GM's groups of dice get depleted, or maybe, you know, they stay the same because the players' characters are losing a lot of these conflicts and everything, and it's all about the change in the characters and their relationships and how they use their hidden agendas and all of these kind of things. So it's, yeah, I mean, I went into that, you know, having pre-done the characters, but, you know, it was great around the table. Everyone contributed stuff to the setup, and with zero idea of how things were, I didn't even know what the central MacGuffin was. It was just, there's this thing that's nicknamed the Basilisk that's making people explode. I have no idea what it is or what might be going on. And it ended up, we managed in 3 and a bit hours to, you know, not in an entire, you know, it wouldn't pass, you know, I don't think from, you know, from my GMing point of view, I wouldn't pass muster as a script writer. Absolutely not. But it was really great that, you know, everyone kind of inputted different stuff into it and the characters changed and evolved and all that kind of thing. It was good fun. And yeah, the first time I've run on a game at a con for such a long time.
that was the experience of playing it once. So how does that, you can do it clearly as a series and a campaign. So how does that work? Does that work differently? Are there like developments by having a series of...
Yeah, so it would be more slow burn, and certainly sort of core to the characters are these things called, well, there's two things that are really core to the development of the characters: hidden agendas and relationships, and hidden in both Cold City and Hot War. And hidden agendas are, each character's two of them. One of them is something they've been told to do by a group or an institution or an organization or some kind of power that they are beholden to. So this is something they've been told to do. And then they have the personal hidden agenda, which is something that they want. You know, it can be something as simple as, like, you know, it's in post-apocalyptic London. I want to find my son who disappeared during the war. Then, you know, that could be something simple. And each of these has a kind of like a rating and a basically a force. You know, so the ones that allow you to, that give you more dice are shorter burn. They go like that. Whereas ones that less dice are a much more longer burn story. And in multi-session games, you've got a lot more space to explore the hidden agendas and have them come to fruition. And it's the same with the relationships that the characters have with other people they're working with loved ones, with enemies, with institutions as well. So they can, you know, go up and down. It can go from a, you know, positively loving relationship to being a relationship of utter hatred, which is unlikely to happen in a single session game, maybe, but, you know, so you have this kind of slower burn changes to the things that really drive the characters.
So that's been released. Have you got any other games on the go, Malcolm?
I have had a game that Johnny Hodgson and from Handiwork Games and I came up while walking along the Union Canal in Falkirk about 15 or 16 years ago because of a mutual interest in shipwreck stories. And the game is brilliantly titled Shipwreck. And it's a map-making game of telling the story of a survival of a shipwreck. And that has been on the back burner for like 15 or 16 years. I've play-tested it a few times. I've tried it with my nephews who are 10 and 12 and they loved it, even though all the shipwreck survivors get eaten by giant crocodiles. Yes, we'll play 10, 12-year-olds. So that's kind of been on the go. And I kind of want to, I've got ideas for kind of like things that follow up on Cold City and Hot War. I want to do, I've always promised myself, I'll do a, you know, like some auteurish kind of idiot. Well, there's the third part of my gaming trilogy, which I need to complete, you know, something that follows on from Hot War. Because, so Hot War is essentially the influence of Twilight 2000. Yeah. On me. That is my Twilight 2000. And also another game that I loved when I was a teenager in my early 20s was 2300 AD, which is a direct follow-on from Twilight 2000. And I want to do something like that for Hot War, you know, take it out to the stars. Oh. Only it has the same themes and ideas of, you know, Event Horizon would be a big influence on it.
Yeah.
And I know Event Horizon has its detractors. I still really like it as a film. Yeah, that's kind of stuff I'm thinking about because, you know, but finding the time to do that and finding anyone.
You've got a book to finish as well, haven't you?
I have. I've got about half of it written over this last semester because I've been on research sabbatical. But that leaves the other half to be completed. And it's the more challenging bit. I've written stuff about Twilight 2000, about Price of Freedom, about Morrow Project. And I need to actually now get into writing a chapter on Gamma World.
Oh, right.
Which is for me actually the most challenging one because Gamma World is such a weird game and there's so many more editions of it compared to, you know, something like Twilight 2000, Morrow Project, etc. That. So, yeah. But it's good. I mean, looking forward to finishing it. It'd be nice to get a complete draft of.
Yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you and I really enjoyed the game as well. So thanks for
that's very, very kind of you on both counts. Thank you very much.
Games Master Screen.
Welcome to the Room of Roleplaying Rambling. I've got Blythe with me. Hello there, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
And we are in the room. We're back up in the room. It's been a while since we've been in the attic.
Yeah, the pigeon loft.
The pigeon loft. The pigeons outside, it's looking a bit suntanned after a summer of roasting five
roast heatwaves. Roast pigeon.
I mean, we stopped coming in here because of the disconcerting bulge that was in the ceiling. It looked a bit...
Yeah. There is a disconcerting bulge in the ceiling.
Well, it's not in here, it's in the corridor, just as you come in.
And like a trap,
we getting in.
Yeah.
What? Spot traps.
Lurker above.
Lurker above, yeah. Spot traps.
Yeah.
Spot bulging ceiling.
It doesn't look like it's been repaired. It just looks like it's been poked at by several people in overalls, but it's still bulging.
It's the people from corporate property department who come in and look at it and go, yeah, it'll be all right, that.
Be all right, that.
Sure.
Yeah.
The ceiling's falling in. There's plaster on the floor. That'll be fine.
Just don't walk underneath it.
Just avoid it. No, but I can't avoid it.
Yeah. I'm erecting this Games Master screen in front of us.
Yeah.
And this one is in the form of a calendar.
Ooh.
Because I thought this time, we'd do RPG a day 2026.
Okay. Now,
you've heard of this?
I've heard of it. Yeah, I have heard of it.
It's been going on for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So this is organised by Autocratic. Remember Dave Chapman? He was a guest in our Doctor Who episode, and Runeslinger. And each August, they put up a set of words for every day, or a set of questions, because I think some of them are a bit less prosaic than the ones that are today, aren't they? Because some of them are things like, what was the first dice you...
Yeah, in the past, they've been quite direct questions, haven't they? Yeah, what was the first this, what's the best that, kind of thing.
Well,
this year's are a little bit more...
Oblique,
I think. Yeah, just like word association.
There is a risk, isn't there, of course, that we might disappear up on our own fundament.
There is, yeah.
Because I've seen some that are...
They're quite strange because they're just a word, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, like desire or something like that. You think, oh, okay.
Granite. Why must I be like granite?
Pride.
Yeah.
Posture.
What's this?
The first word that comes into your head.
Our friends at Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice Podcast, Mike and Roger, every year, they go through all 31 and they put forward the views on it. Yeah, but I just didn't
think... We're not going to do all 31.
We're not going to do it.
Thank God for that.
We can't do quick fire, can we?
No, we don't really do that.
And we're not even medium
quite fire as well. We don't want to do all 31.
No.
We don't want to subject people to it either, to be fair.
So what I've got the calendar here.
Okay.
And I want to roll on a D30, apparently at random.
Okay. A D30.
You got one of them, haven't you?
I've got a few. I've got 3 D30s.
Are they cultural artifacts from the cult of DCC?
They are. Yeah, they are artifacts from the cult of DCC.
Did you have to get permission from the High Priest for us to use it?
I did. To use them in a non-DCC setting. Yes. I did have to get permission. I have.
Well,
you may roll away. Brace yourself as well, because when you roll a D30, you have to wait 20 minutes until it stops rolling. Because really, it's a ball, isn't it?
It's essentially a ball.
It's a ball, really.
It's a ball,
isn't it?
It's a ball with numbers on it.
Around. Yeah.
Right, here goes then. First one. Okay, 25. Familiarity. So familiarity. So I suppose familiarity for me, it will mean system mastery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stuff that you know. So rule systems that you know. Not only that, it's lore that you know. So if you've got a setting that you know particularly well, you could be a bit more fluent in that setting, can't you, as a player?
Mm.
And similarly, if you know the rules, as a player, you can act with a bit more confidence and less dependency on the game master.
Yeah, I would agree.
What degree of familiarity would you expect from your players?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? It was a convention. I always come at a convention. If I'm running a game at a convention, I always come at it from the perspective of they won't know anything, even if that is unlikely. So if you're running Old School Essentials, for example, I always assume, well, let's assume they won't know anything about it. This is unlikely, because even if you've never played Old School Essentials, if you've played a D&D type game, you're going to have a relative grasp of it, aren't you? But I always assume that they don't. And I wouldn't expect them to. I don't think there'd be any criticism at a convention if they didn't know the rules. Because I've played games at conventions where I don't know the rules, you know. So, and I've not even got the rule book. And you kind of sampling it, aren't you, maybe at a convention. You might think, oh, I've never played that. I fancy I'll have a go at that. So, but I suppose if it was a campaign, you'd like to think that even if players didn't know the rules for the first couple of sessions, they would try and get their head around those rules.
So what's more important, though, for them to be more familiar with the setting or more familiar with the rules? What's your expectation? If you're going into that campaign mode...
As a rules lawyer, I say the rules.
Well, I think the rules you can kind of get by. Yeah. Right? You can stumble along with the rules, but...
It can be. If it's a campaign and you're five sessions in and some players still not got basic grounds for the rules, can be quite annoying.
That's annoying.
A bit annoying, can't it?
So five.
So what do I roll again? Do I roll a D20 for this? Yes, you do. That kind of thing. There's so five, a little bit of that sometimes.
Five sessions in, that's the point.
Well, maybe, yeah. Yeah, you think, less than that. But
yeah. So it's starting to worry after... Right, session four.
It's a patience rest thing. Come on, I'm playing this for a bit.
I think you're right. I think you do need to pick up the rules. But I always think that people settle into a setting, that's when they can start coming up with the ideas, knowing what's available to them and what they can interact with.
True. But I think it depends in a way. The setting can depend, be very... Settings, the settings are settings, isn't there? So I suppose for my, I always think there's rule. All games have rules. All role-play games have rules and systems, don't they? But some games don't really have much of a setting. Depends, doesn't it? So the setting's not always an issue. And some settings are more complicated than others. But rules, I always think players understanding the rules when you're doing a bit of a campaign or a few sessions is good, because it can slow things down a bit, can't it? If people are stumbling over the rules all the time, it can slow things down a bit in terms of the run of play, I suppose. You know?
You know what they say about familiarity, though, don't you?
Go on. Does it breed contempt?
It breeds contempt. Oh. So at what point do you become overly familiar with...
Too familiar.
Too familiar. And it starts to get on your nerves.
Well... You see, we've played a lot of Savage World, haven't we?
Yes.
And I don't dislike Savage World, but I think what I've noticed is with a game that I play a lot of, and it's not just Savage World, it's like when we've played D&D a lot, you find yourself gravitating to the same things, don't you?
Yes.
Or I do, at least. I can't help myself. It's like Savage Worlds. I can't help but go for that look edge.
Yeah.
Every time. And then later on, as my character's advancing, I can't help but go for great luck, where you're getting two extra bennies rather than one extra benny. Because the thing is, you can do a lot with a benny in Savage Worlds, can't you?
Yeah.
You can re-roll, you can spend it for this, you can, if you've got an arcane background, you can spend it for more power points, you can soak down. Lots of things I can't help myself, but always think that's one of the best edges you can go for.
Yes.
And so I always go for it. So like you said, this is also, I don't know if it's contempt, but it's that thing of, I know this game so well. I've played it so many times. I know that maybe not for everyone, but my style of play and the characters I play, the look edge and the great look edge are the two I'm going to go for.
Yeah.
Eventually I'll tell myself not to. Don't do that again. Oh, but no, I will.
It's become like the medium shield and bastard sword combo in BRP.
Yeah, that was a thing in RuneQuest back in the day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We worked out that the absolute optimum weapon was a bastard sword with a plus 1d4 damage bonus. So you wanted a strength of 13, you wanted a size of 13, and I think you got a d4 damage bonus, and you could wield a bastard sword one-handed and use a medium shield, and that was the optimum weapon to use in combat. So we all had them. Everyone had them. And if you rolled a character who couldn't wield a bastard sword one-handed, you felt somehow, cheated now.
Coming back to Savage Worlds, I also think that it does affect, if you play a lot of something, because it's so familiar, you're waiting for, example, exploding dice. And if you don't get exploding dice, you feel slightly disappointed.
You feel like with it. Robbed a bit, yeah.
And you know how the run of a conflict is going to go, and that you just go sort of going through the motions because it is so familiar to you.
Yeah.
And you are praying sometimes for those little subsystems in Savage Worlds just to mix things up a little bit, like the battle rules or the quick encounter rules.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It is true. I sat up like last week. I had an impromptu game of 5th edition D&D with a friend of mine. His son was back from university. Ran a game of D&D. So I had to create a character. I said, oh, create a 5th level character. Create a druid. I always create a druid because I know that with there's only two players and the other guy always wants to play a fighter character. Don't want to play a wizard because they're a bit too weak when there's only two players. So want a bit of magic, go for a druid. So you just zero in on be a druid and then pick, call lightning. Yeah, always pick that one. Always pick this, always pick that. Because as you say, you know that in the rule of play, that will be useful.
Yes.
And it's that thing of dismissing certain spells by going, oh, it's a good spell, but you never use that. Never crops. Not worth it because the chances of it cropping up in play are not worth it. It's because you're so familiar with the game and the way it operates. And the way the encounters operate, that you're right, you just end up doing the same thing, don't you?
So familiarity may not breed contempt, but it breeds power gaming.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, maybe.
Maybe. Anyway, that's the first
one. Power gaming, just
optimization.
You don't have a tensor floating disk, do you? When you know that it's no use whatsoever. In the
game. Want a tensor floating.
You did once, but and it was useless. There you go.
Familiarity. That's the first one.
I'm glad we got that out of the way, because saying familiarity, which I didn't count this week.
They don't get much better, actually.
Oh, do they not?
Okay. No. There's 30 of these. This is why we can't do all of them.
We spent 20 minutes on that.
Oh, yeah, dear. Let's roll the ball again.
All right, roll the ball.
10. Secret, and you're going to lead on this one.
Secret. Well, I'm a big fan of secrets in role-playing games. As you know, I love a game with Master Screen. I like to keep things behind a game master screen. But I also like things being kept from me behind a game master screen. You know, I'm of the view that the game master should have secrets and know things that we don't know. And that's a good thing in role playing. It's like magic. It's like magic tricks. I see it as almost same as a magic trick that, you know, you know it's a trick, but you don't really want to know how it's done because that might spoil the fun of it. So I think secrets in role-playing are a great thing.
What about secret agendas between players?
Yeah. So that's that can be trickier, I think. Yeah, I like the games not to have secrets. So I like a good mystery scenario where something's going on that you've got to work out this, that, and the other. I like all that. You know, I don't like this idea that everything's open and, you know, I'd hate to sit at a table and see the GM's notes by accident. Put it behind the screen. But on the flip side to it, secret agendas, they can be a bit problematic, can't they, I think.
So I've been playing Cartel and also Hot War.
Yeah.
And they have a mechanic or an element of the game where it's an open table.
Yeah.
So players do have secret agendas and secret motivations, but you each know what they are. So everybody, and I've never encountered that before.
No, that's very interesting, isn't it?
Where I've seen it before is where, you know, the players keep it to themselves and they hide it, but everybody knowing what each other's up to adds another element to it because it does bring in that sense of irony. Because there's another player, you can play up to the secret.
I quite like that. When you told me about that, I quite liked it. Because I think one of the problems with players having secrets, it's odd this, isn't it? It's an odd dynamic because if the GM's there with this huge screen.
Massive.
It's massive.
Like a riot
shield. Like a Berlin Wall.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like massive GM screen. The bigger the better. The bigger the psychological barrier, the better, as far as I'm concerned. It's the only piece of cardboard. But hey, anyway. There's something, I always find it's perfectly acceptable for the GM to pull a clever or mean trick on the players. I almost enjoy it as a player. If you fool or something happens where you think, oh, God, didn't see that. Why could we not see that coming? Yeah. You know, is it great?
Particularly if it's a twist that's been telegraphed.
Yeah.
And you've missed the clues.
Brilliant. Yeah. I like that. I don't mind that. It's a trap that you as players, you think you're all right, but you've missed something and it's like, oh, of course, you know.
Yeah.
That's great. What's less great is a player pulling that trick on another player.
Yes.
That creates a bit of smart-ass tension, doesn't it, then?
Yeah.
As if, well, I've fooled you. That seems somehow worse than the GM doing it. It's almost like I accept the GM's trying to do that because it's his job, her job, to do that. But another player, whereas that idea in Cartel's quite innovative, is I quite like that you might fall foul of another player's gender, but you're doing that willingly as part of the story, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're doing it.
There's a difference between character knowledge and player knowledge.
Exactly, yeah.
And
it eliminates the smart-arsery.
Yeah.
So if one player's an undercover cop, you know he's an undercover cop, but the idea is you as a player, your character doesn't know, and you can play up to that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you don't know he's an undercover cop, and at the end he gets you all arrested, it's a bit like, ha, 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 ha. They've got one over on you. It can create a kind of atmosphere, I think.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
No, less of a problem in a convention one shot. I mean, I've played convention one shots where people have had agendas. That's kind of all right. Okay, whatever.
I still think that they're a problem for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is that sometimes players miss it. So if you've got a... Yeah. scenario, convention scenarios that's dependent on the revelation of some secret or other.
Yeah.
If players have missed it for whatever reason, then you've missed a component of the game, haven't you?
Yeah.
And the other bit is, you don't know each other at the table, do you? So that smart-arsery revelation can backfire.
Yeah.
But I think the idea within Cold City, Hot War, and what I've seen in Cartel, I think it's a really good idea, really good. And last year I tried running a Blade Runner game based on The Man Who Was Thursday, and that's a secret agent.
Yeah.
They're all, in the novel it turns out that they're all secret agents, but they don't realise. And trying to realise that as a game, I found really difficult. But I think by using that device, it works. So we're saying that secrets for GMs, secret for players using different modes.
Open secrets for players, maybe.
Yeah.
GM secrets, fine. I suppose, like you said as well, the idea that if you're relying on all the players to have secrets and reveal secrets, and yet the players miss their own secret, that can be a problem.
Yeah.
But at least the GM knows the secret and thinks, I need to somehow shoehorn this twist into this scenario at all costs because it's important. That's different from one of the players being, I think I ran a game ages ago like that.
It was a Traveller one, wasn't it?
Where
somebody missed
something. And I thought, oh, you've not picked up on that, have you? And that, but there's not a lot you can do then as a GM. You're giving that responsibility to players, aren't you? Which is perhaps a bit unfair.
Yeah.
No.
But if you're up front and say, right, you're the replicant. The rest of you don't know that he's a replicant.
Yeah.
You're an undercover cop, but the rest of the...
Well, that was one of our criticisms of the Alien game. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Where when you play Alien, the Free League one, they have this thing where, oh, well, you know, players might not know who the replicant is. And we did that. And did Mark play the replicant?
But he started rolling more dice.
He rolled like 96. Everyone went, no, he's a replicant then, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's got...
What would the harm have been of knowing?
Exactly. That Cartel thing is a great idea, because what you do now, what I would do now if I was playing Alien, I would say, this player's a replicant.
Yeah.
You lot do not know he's a replicant.
Yeah.
So play up to that idea that when he does something that's super strong, you might not think he's a replicant. You might just think he's got a lucky strike or something like that on the door or whatever. Yeah. Not that he's a replicant. And that's how it is, an interesting approach to just be open about it.
Yeah. Secrets. There you go. That's the second one. We're doing well. Let's get the ball rolling. Okay. Number two, stature. Now, my interpretation of this is standing up. Standing up or sitting down.
Yeah.
So as a GM at conventions, I always stand up. I always stand up, at least for part of the session, usually for the entire bit of it. But when I'm playing my home game, I sit down. So why is that? What is the difference?
Well, I do the same. I didn't used to stand up when I played a game round a table at a convention. And I saw other people did it, and I did it then. And then when I did it, I thought, oh, actually, it's actually much easier to do it that way. Even though I'm huge, I just think sometimes I stand up and think, they're all sat down, and I'm huge. I'm not sure it is a good idea, but maybe it seems to work. Yeah, I don't know. But when you play at home, you're online usually, aren't you?
Yeah. But even if we're playing at Eddie's, I won't stand up at Eddie's.
Eddie stands up, though.
He does, doesn't he? But I don't.
No.
He does.
But what I found with standing up thing is it's better to hear and engage all the players.
Yeah.
Because I find what happens is if you sat down and you're on a circular table, the players to your left and right feel more involved than the player right on the opposite side of the table.
Yeah.
Whereas if I stand up, I can hear what people are saying more. Again, conventions, you're in a room with lots of other games, so there can be a bit of a noise issue. Whereas if I stand up, I can lean into the table a bit and hear what people are saying.
Yeah.
In ways that when I'm sat down, I can't hear the players on the other side of the table.
That's the main reason why I started standing up in those situations, is because I'm a low talker, bit of a mumbler. And so... So by standing up, it forced me to project.
Yeah.
I also think there's an element of control as well when you're stood up as a GM. It means that you can direct the action a bit more and make sure you're bringing people in.
Yeah. That's a definite thing, the feeling of bringing people in. So that, again, the people that either sat immediately left and right are not. I mean, they are the closest, but they're not. But they don't feel like they're much closer, and the person on the other side of the table is much further away. When you stand up, it feels that somewhere everyone's got a similar proximity to you as a GM, and you have to them as players. And maybe you don't stand up at Eddie's because there's only two players.
Yeah,
in Eddie's kitchen, and it's always nice and quiet, so it doesn't really need it.
I also think that by standing up, it energizes you more and injects a bit of pace into it because you're feeling naturally energized.
Yeah.
And it's easier to hold people's attention and bring them in and set the pace. And you can move about. That's the other thing. That's the thing I've learned from Paul Fricker. You know, you go behind players and pace behind them. And when they're plotting things, like whisper stuff into people's ears. So you can, you've got a bit more of a dynamic activity if you're standing. So standing, I'm all for it.
I am. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I would never have, when we got back into gaming, I would never have thought I would end up standing up as a GM. But I do now all the time.
Another element is like part of my technique is a Games Master. And this is what I miss online, really, is the art of mime.
The art of mime.
Because I do feel that...
Steady on.
Well, because...
The art of mime.
Yes.
Have I seen this? Where do you remember?
Well, no, because like, part of it is performance, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. So, because we use theatre of the mind over miniatures, sometimes you mind the proximity that you are.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I thought you meant you did that thing where there's an imaginary glass wall in front of you.
I do that as well.
You do that as well. Cut a hole in it.
I
cut a hole.
I think Gaz from the Smart Party describes it as cabaret GMing. When I went to the Dice on the Borderlands convention, I had a pillar next to me, and that pillar ended up being a prop because I would be able to hide behind it, use it as a kind of a... So it's all like a physical experience if you stand
up, I think,
as a GM.
Yeah.
Mm. All part of theatre of the mind. Right, let's roll again.
Roll the ball.
Roll the ball. This is you leading on this one again. And that's four, day four, charm.
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 Well, when you mention charm, you're role-playing, you immediately think of charm person. You think of charm spells, don't you? I suppose. Which I think are one of the trickiest things in any role-playing game.
Yeah.
The thing about player agency, players being charmed or seduced or...
Yeah, because it appears a lot as...
It's a big thing in a lot of... Yeah, I'm looking at like Dolmenwood for Owlbear, and you read that and it's all about fairy magic and people being seduced and charmed and fooled and all that kind of thing. But it's a tricky thing to... It's a very easy thing to write in a rule book, isn't it? But it's a difficult thing to GM and play. So it's difficult for GMs, isn't it? Because when an NPC gets charmed, sometimes it's like, oh, right, okay. Yeah, that's blown a hole in things because now...
He can reveal my secret.
He can reveal the secrets or do things that, you know, oh, right, okay. But equally, when players are charmed, you know, the idea of... You know, I had a recent experience where I was running some Shadow Dark. I was running Helpits of Nightfang, famous, you know, with Kay's scenario. And one of the players at one point was charmed by the vampire. And the player kind of looked at me as GM, almost to say, well, what do you want me to do? And that's kind of an odd moment where you think, well, I don't know, maybe as a gamer, as a player, it's up to you what you do. But you have to play it like you're charmed, like you're now an ally of the vampire.
A bit like the open secret thing.
Yeah, but
equally, you know you're charmed, so how would you behave? Yeah,
but equally, there's that awkwardness when the players, I'm now on the side of the vampire, I've got a wand of fireballs. All right, okay, what's he going to do? But he kind of looks at me as if wanting, really, could you make the decision, please, that I'm going to kill everyone in the room? Rather than me make that decision.
But being charmed is part of drama, isn't it?
Mm.
And that's why, a bit like Bloody Dreams. Bloody Dreams appear.
You don't like dreams.
I don't like dreams in role playing. But it's a familiar trope from drama
that
comes in.
Yeah.
And it presents awkwardness, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's a tricky. It's one of the kind of bugbears of role playing. It's a tricky thing to deal with. But at the same time, it's one of the most common things certainly in fantasy role playing games.
Yeah.
One of those common things, isn't it? But
maybe the way to deal with it is the way that Free League deals with the actions of monsters. So that you have a table. So that
That's sort of a good idea, isn't it? That, yeah. You are charmed, you will do one of these six things, roll a d6 every round. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think some games probably do that, don't they?
Yeah.
Sometimes they have a mechanical effect, don't they? Because I think if you've got fear in
it's fear in this, and you get fear where you roll.
Insanity.
You can choose. Can't you choose from three things with fear in this? I think you can choose whether to run away, faint, or do this. And that's quite good because it's that thing of you're taking agency away from the player, but equally, you're not just saying to the player, well, go on, what are you going to do at this point?
Or I will determine what
I'll determine what you do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although the charm thing is slightly different from fear. I mean, a lot of games have, like Dolmenwood has fear, you're right, you run away, you do this, you do that. But charm sometimes is often left a little bit more open, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you're now under the control of the villain or the villain's under your control, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Is the GM going to decide what they do?
So what's worse then, charm or hold person?
You just kill them, that's that. So mind you, at least it eliminates the problem of what are they going to do because they're dead. So you don't have to worry about that, do you?
Yeah, that's true.
I suppose if you've got a monster that can charm people or hold people, you've got to consider what happens if the whole party succumbs to it, haven't you?
There's
a good GM. I was putting some together for Dom, wouldn't I? Giving too much away, but there's a bit in it where I thought, oh, this could end up with everybody asleep. What happens? You know, you put something, if that happens, then this is what will happen. This is where they'll find themselves. And that's all right. But you've got to, I think if the monsters have got those powers, you've got to think about the consequences of everybody rolling a duff dice. And you think, he's like a whole person, isn't he?
Yeah.
if the bad guy can hold person. And you've got to think about what happens if all the players are held.
You've got to be true to it as well, in that if a monster has that in its arsenal,
they would use it.
It would use it.
It would use it, yeah. Absolutely.
The
yeah.
reason why yeah. a vampire charms is to break down your resistance.
Yeah, of course, that's how it works. Yeah, you'd be a fool as a GM if you didn't use it. Yeah.
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 But it's tricky when the players use it, because, of course, it's in their gift what happens, isn't it, then?
Charm.
That's one of the only words in the whole flipping list that actually makes you think of an actual role-playing thing.
I've seen some variations, though. Is it necessarily to be a charming role player?
In my experience, no.
No.
I'm not sure charm is charm. How many charming role players do you meet? Hello.
Present company accepted.
Yes.
Roll the ball again. Okay, 23. Fortune.
Okay.
Now, I have opinions on people who collect role-playing games.
Do you?
And believe.
Are you prepared to share these on? Are you prepared to share this in the podcast?
Yeah. And they believe that they're sitting on a nest egg. The pension.
All right, that kind of fortune. Not gold pieces, a dragon sat on. It's games that are gamers yeah. sat on.
When we first started getting back into this and we were trying to recover some of our lost collection, we used to invite Eddie on, didn't we?
Yeah.
To be like an eBay consultant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when I listened back to those, he used to say, about a tenner.
About a tenner.
Help It's a Night Fan. Yeah, you'll be able to get that for about a tenner. If you try and get the Help It's a Night Fan now on eBay.
The original one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll be paying a lot more than a tenner.
Would you? How much would we pay?
About 60, 70
yeah,
pounds.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And that seems to be the going price.
Right.
But we have on the Discord of the Grog Pod.
Yes, we do.
If anybody wants an invitation, get in touch with me. We do have a channel that's called eBay Exclaiming.
Yeah, eBay Exclaiming.
Where the collective of the Grog Pod community find things on eBay that are outrageous prices. Mm-hmm. Okay. And one of them that we found was Bunnies and Burrows. Bunnies and Burrows, which we talked about last time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can get it as a PDF for $5 on DriveThruRPG.
Yeah, okay.
You can download it.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
£3. Three of your English pounds.
Yeah, £3 one sheet, yeah.
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 There is somebody on eBay currently selling a printed version of that PDF.
A printed version of the PDF?
Yes.
Well, the PDF you could print out?
Yeah.
Okay.
For £700. First edition, Bunnies and Burrows, print on demand, £700. That's just outrageous, isn't it? Where did these prices come from?
But hang on, it's not the original thing.
No.
So, I mean, don't get me wrong, £700 for the original thing would seem ridiculous. I'm not defending that, but it's not the original thing. It's someone who's gone to drive through,
printed it,
and gone, right, I'll put a couple of staples in this and sell it £700.
That is precisely what it is, yeah. And recently I saw Mike Brunton, the late Mike Brunton from Imagine Magazine.
Yeah.
He famously did a module for D&D that was a limited edition that was done. Is it set in a garden? I can't remember the name of it. People will be going crazy. Google it and you'll find it. And it is a kind of a rare item. It's a notably rare item. It was sold. So it wasn't just advertised on eBay.
Sold
for £15,000. £15,000.
Some people do have more money than sense, don't they?
But my point on this is, I'm sorry to say to both people who are spending all this money on it, is that another 15 or 20 years?
It's a demographic thing, isn't it?
It's a demographic.
The demographic thing, definitely. That Mike Brunton thing will be worth absolutely nothing to our children's generation.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
It's a sad thing. And I think it's hard for people to think like that.
Yeah.
But
they're not. See, there's a difference, isn't there, between Picasso and some rule book, first edition rule book. Picasso, it's like something culturally present all the time. It's not going to, not like at some point people are going to go, Picasso, who's he? Oh, that's just rubbish. Let's throw it in the bin. But gaming is a different thing altogether, isn't it? Because it's only of interest. Bunnies and Burrows is only of interest to a certain bunch of people from a certain generation.
I think even art is subject to fluctuations.
Well, it is. It is. But what I mean is it's not. There are some things that have a value that it's very difficult to imagine that value will vanish.
But I think gaming material from the 80s and 70s will go the way of brown furniture and railway.
Books on steam trains.
Books on steam
trains. Steam train records. Remember those?
Yeah, yeah.
One of my uncles had some of those. They were like the vinyls were just steam trains. Yeah. Noise of steam trains. Yeah.
And the reason why my father-in-law used to collect railway model ideas. Full of railway memorabilia. Nobody wanted it. And unfortunately, the same thing will happen when we shuffle off this mortal coil.
Yeah, yeah.
The demographic will have passed away who are interested in this stuff.
Yeah.
But also, there'll be a flood in the market because we've all passed away.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. It's such a kind of precarious thing, isn't it? It's like Antiques Roadshow. I always laugh at the end. I like the Antiques Roadshow because I like to enjoy people's disappointment, So it's always good when they look at a mug or something and go, oh, yeah, this was made in the 1800s. Yes, they're quite rare. Yes, they're very, collectible. The market is interested in them at the moment. And it's worth £100. And you can see the other person thinking, £100,000, £100, slight pause, £100.
Yeah.
Maybe £110. I like, it puts me a bad light, doesn't it? But I like the look of disappointment. They go, oh, thank you. Well, I don't think we'll be selling it. No, I've been in the family a long time. That's very interesting. Thank you. But no, you crushed out because you thought it was worth a fortune. And that's someday to Bunnies and Burrows, won't they? They'll come to the Antiques Roadshow with Bunnies and Burrows. And they'll start out. And how much did you pay for this? Well, I paid £700 on eBay for this. Did you? Yeah, back in 2026. £700, yeah. All right. Well, it's worth now £7.
£7.
£7. Oh, thank you. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. You see it in a skip on the way out of the Antiques Roadshow. Bunnies and Burrows in the skip.
There we go. Fortune and the sordid business of money.
Yeah.
There we go.
Move on from that.
Let's do the last one, and I'm going to roll it. It's 24, day 24, distance.
Distance. Well, I suppose distance to me conjures up. I do find it a great thing in our gaming life that we play with people from all over the world. Kind of really good aspect of online play, isn't it? But, you'd never have thought that back in the day that we'd end up in a regular game with someone who lives in Sydney, Australia.
Yeah.
It is an amazing thing, I think, that, never mind people from other parts of the world or parts of the country, which of course we do, but also just other parts of the world. It's an amazing thing, and it's kind of opened up our gaming, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Incredibly, that, you can contact people on the other side of the world or the other side of the country and that kind of thing,
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the distance. For me, that's what distance conjures up distance. When I think of role-playing games.
Yeah, and as we've remarked before, back in the day when we looked in those white dwarf small lads. And somebody being Wigan.
Yeah, I know. Wigan?
How are we going to get to Wigan?
A passport to get there.
Yeah,
probably do, actually. But it's true, isn't it? That's the idea that it was like a million miles away. You couldn't, it's two buses. You had to get two buses.
At least two.
Can't go there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now it's just a flick of a switch and you get four or five people from
wherever you are in the world.
I do think that's a really good thing. And great in that it gives you different perspectives on gaming, because you are getting different views and different approaches to it.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. Gets you out of the kind of rut that you can sometimes find yourself in if you've just got a home group of people. Yeah. It's like us back in the day with Eddie and Simon. We played the games the way we played them. We played the games we had, but there was no input from anyone else. It wasn't like anyone else came along and ran a game for us with a different outlook or a different game or anything like that. So it was great what we were doing, but it becomes very narrow. Whereas when you've got the opportunity to open it up to the world, people come along and you can play a game that you've not played before with people who might play in a slightly different way or a slightly different style.
Yeah, I don't know. This is an element that fascinates me, because you begin to realise once you're exposed to people from different countries that their gaming culture has a different ecology to in the UK, don't we? We have a set of assumptions. Our gaming experience is very much shaped through the distribution of Games Workshop. Mm.
Yeah.
Whereas in other countries, that's not quite the same, is it? As we found out from Magnusita, in Sweden, that experience was different. In Belgium, the experience was different.
It'd be a different, different experience in different countries. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's like a great thing now, that you can get contact with those people quite easily. And
I wonder what impact, or whether it's noticeable yet, what effects those merging of different gaming cultures has.
Mm.
It's not been measured anywhere, is it? That kind
No. It won't take another 20 years for someone to write a thesis on that.
Yes.
You know, work out how it all impacts.
There we go.
It's true. It's like the Free League stuff, isn't it? Free League stuff coming from Sweden. That's elements of that. If you were prepared to argue, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, there's elements of those games that are coming from Swedish gaming culture. They've definitely had an impact in the UK, because these games are very popular, aren't they?
Yeah.
So that's come across, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And it's not sure what they are, but you know, you can probably make an argument to say these are, you know, certain different like cultural trends or national trends in gaming.
Yeah.
And attitudes.
I suppose D&D itself is a clash of culture in a sense. It's like bringing the folksy, homely charms of Tolkien's Albion with the Wild West.
Yeah. And people have said that, haven't they, I suppose? It's like the Warhammer versus D&D thing, where people have said, Warhammer role-playing is gritty and slight, it has dark comedy to it. And it's a very British... You know, I've read things people.
Yeah.
It's a very British.
2000 AD.
Yeah. You know, just British sensibility. Whereas something like 5th edition D&D, I would say, I'm not saying it's an American sensibility. I don't know what it is, but it doesn't feel I don't think 5th edition D&D feels necessarily very British in its outlook on fantasy and the way it approaches fantasy. It has almost like a superhero quality to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
As if it's coming out of Marvel in some ways, feeding into it, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone's super powered and has magic and all that. When you look at Warhammer, it's a very British, sort of slightly, you know, run down world of people who are rat catchers and all of it
which
are all a bit weird and rubbish. Something wrong with them. They're not very clean cut, are they? Like, D&D characters are more. Yeah, the illustration, the artwork all kind of presents people as like wonderfully coiffured elves looking brilliant, whereas Warhammer all look a bit rubbish.
There you go. That's our contribution to RPG Day 2026.
Okay.
There you go. We've done it. Well done.
That's good. Oh, at least we can do all 31 days.
We could do if you want.
No, you're all right.
I'll get me caught. We're wandering towards the door. It's coming to an end. We need to dodge the bulge in the ceiling. But before we go, we've got some final chatter. We should say, shouldn't we, that we were going to do a groggle box to complement our interview.
No, yeah, we were, weren't we? Yeah.
On Red Dawn.
Yeah, Red Dawn.
But we came to the conclusion that it was a poor film, but not bad enough to warrant.
Not bad enough to give us any material. Yeah. Like one of those films that you think, oh, it's rubbish, but sort of
competently bad.
Competent, yeah, the worst kind of films, really.
Yeah.
You're watching a really bad film is better than watching something that's competently, just competently bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for that reason, we've eschewed that, and we'll have to do a Groggle Box at some point. But have you got any closing time chatter? Anything that's affecting you at the moment?
Mama, I don't know.
What are you taking to our...
As we speak, I'm preparing my Dolmer Wood scenario for Owlbear, yeah. So I'm preparing that.
So Owlbear the Wizard Staff,
yeah.
The annual convention that's held in...
Leamington Spa. Royal Leamington Spa.
Which I can't go to this
time. I know, I feel slightly guilty. I feel a lot of, you know, we're like a double act. I feel like, you know...
Well, the FOMO is already set, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Mm. It's a couple of weeks after, and I'm already feeling FOMO.
Yeah, but it'll soon pass, don't worry. You know, before you know it'll be Saturday night, it'll be over. We always say that because of these conventions, don't we?
Yeah.
There's the build-up, and then before you know it, you're on the train, Friday night, Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, Saturday night. Oh, right, Saturday night. Oh, it's Sunday morning. Oh, wow, I'm going to get the train home then. That's it. It's over with.
I'm drawn to all the preparations that people are making. They're meeting up to have curries, and
I'm sobbing. Nothing worse, is there? Nothing worse. Like the first time when you went to Expo, the first time we were looking forward to Expo, and then Theresa May called a general election and I couldn't go.
Yeah,
and it was that. I felt like that. I thought, oh God, I was going to go to Expo, and the first time we'd ever been, wasn't it? I didn't go, did I?
Yeah.
It is a bad feeling.
So the Dolmer Wood adventure that you're preparing, is it a pre-written one, or is it one?
It's one I've invented, but the good thing about Dolmer Wood is it's such a good setting. There's so many ideas in it. It's that nice sweet spot where you can read a bit around certain hexes on the map and go, oh, okay, I can see that. That might work. This might work. What about this, that, the other, and come up with something. It's quite good. That's what I like about it. It's a very rich setting, but it's also one of those settings that is very geared towards actual adventures. So, you know, when you get some setting books and you read them and you think, this is all fine, but what am I supposed to do with it?
Yeah.
Dolmer is the opposite of that. It's one of those settings that you read and think, oh, yeah, I could do something with that. And I could do something with that. And I could do something. You know, it's full of ideas and little kind of adventure hooks.
Yeah.
Little locations with stuff going on that you can latch onto and build something on. So it's kind of one I've written, but at the same time, it's fair to say, it's built on what's in there, you know, like piecing something together. That's, which is very, in some ways, it's the perfect form of lonely fun. Because it's not like you're staring at a blank sheet of paper going, okay, I need to come up with an adventure. What should I do? But equally, it's not a pre-written adventure. It's you've got the building blocks in there that you can play around with and move around to come up with something. So it's quite good fun.
I like Dolmer Wood mechanically as well, because it's old school essentials, just with a little bit more
with
a twist.
Tweaks. Yeah, a few twist. Little tweaks in it. Yeah.
Like, give it a little bit more, don't they? They kind of give it a little bit extra.
Yeah.
As a player, you've got more things to draw upon.
Yeah. The character classes are slightly more interesting. So even the fighter character class, which is the most basic of all of them, in it, has some little abilities that you can pick, choose a few fighter type abilities. So yeah, there's a bit more going on in it, and some of the character races are quite good as well. They're just the kindreds, as they call them. You know, you've got different creatures in there. So it's a very, very, very good setting. You know, one of my favourites, really.
Oh, good luck with it. I hope you have a good time at Owlbear.
Thank you for that heartfelt comment. I know you mean it.
My closing tactic, I mentioned, didn't I, that I've started Cartel.
Mm.
And it is a nut that I've wanted to crack for a while. I talked about it in one of the podcasts that we did about gangsters, because in terms of genre, gangsters is my favourite thing. You know, I love reading about gangster stuff, and I love gangster movies, love The Sopranos. And I've always been intrigued by Cartel, but I've been put off it because of the setting. It's set in Mexico against the background of, I suppose it's trying to emulate narco fiction.
Yeah.
However, it's such a brutal and live experience that people are living through. I've always been put off by
it.
But Sid offered to run a game for us on the back of a podcast that we did for All Anthrex's Gaming Vexes, where we talked about games that we quite like the idea of, but we step away from. And we've had session zero, and I've realised that actually it's not as I imagined. I thought it was going to be a bit like Blades in the Dark, where you played gangsters and you were doing heists and playing them off. But it's not like that at all. You're playing characters who are trying to hold everything together against the background of crime, narcotics, corruption, and all the pressures that in the boiling pot of things like Narcos or Breaking Bad or genre series or television series. So I'm really looking forward to it because I'm really drawn to it. I'm playing the spouse. So I'm playing Carmela Soprano, who is married to the mob, but trying to keep the family together.
It does sound good. I must admit, when you said you were playing it, I thought, oh, no, it's not for me. Because I think when you said you were playing it, I think it coincided actually with some report on the news I think it was Venezuela, not Mexico. But I remember watching this news thinking, my God, as a role playing saying that is grim, that would be awful. That would actually cope with it. The way you kind of explained it to me is not really like that at all. I think it's just sound quite clever how they've approached it. As we were saying earlier, you've got that open secrets thing, haven't you?
Yeah.
And you've got that idea that, like you say, I suppose like Breaking Bad or like Narcos, the idea that as a player character, you are surviving in this world rather than just going around shooting people and trying to...
Yeah,
trying to
bully people.
Win all the turf and all that kind of thing. Because that's a bit... funny or weird, isn't it? Because that's quite violent and that's what really is going on. But the way you explained it reminded me more of something like Breaking Bad, which I only watched recently. My daughter's a big fan of it and she rewatched it and I'd never watched it.
Mm.
And it is a fantastic TV show, really, really good TV show.
Mm.
But the way you describe now Cartel, it is a bit like that. That's about someone who gets involved in the world of illegal drugs. It all seems to be fine until they realise they're really locked into it, can't get out of it. Maybe don't want to get out of it, but it brings the family into it. And
they're
essentially surviving in that world.
Yeah.
And the story is more about surviving in that world than anything else, really.
So
that, and it sounds like Cartel is a similar sort of thing.
I'm really interested in how it develops. We're doing a 6-session campaign, if you want to call it that. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing how things play out. But I will report back here.
Yeah, well, if it's that good, you should run some.
Okay.
Ready to go.
Nice one.
All right.
That's it.
See you soon.
Adios.
Bye-bye.
Never mind the dice rolls. At last, there's something to read. Campaign ideas. Reviews of both old and new games. And much, much more. This is the answer to the void that we have found. Find Nevermind the Dice Rolls on Patreon and DriveThruRPG.
There isn't another bit. Thank you to Malcolm for spending some time talking to us. And you can get hold of his games, Hot War, Cold City, from Handiwork Games. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's that time of year where we're planning Grog Meet, and you'll be able to see updates of that on thegrognardfiles.com. A couple of weeks before Grog Meet, we'll also have Grog Meet-ish, the online version. Again, just check it out on the website. We've also reopened the One Shot Club, and I'll be running a game of Bunnies and Burrows. I know, in the next few weeks. And also Blythe will be running a game of Outgunned. So if you want to take part in that, you need to be part of the patron, the Grog Squad, the people who make a financial contribution to keep this show on the road. We're grateful to anyone who listens to this, adds reviews, passes it on. But it's the patrons that keep the wolf from the door and encourage us to continue doing it. And over the last few months, it's been a while since I've done these thank you bits, we've had some new patrons and some people coming and going. So what I like to do in this case is, at people at a certain level, I need to roll on a table, apparently at random, and give them a gift from the game under discussion. Now, it has to be said that The Price of Freedom doesn't necessarily have loads of tables. That's a good thing, isn't it? So what I've done is I've chosen to pick some goodies from the American Strategic Direction to award to patrons who've joined us recently. Joining us at the Fancy Poof level is Fabio. Hello, Fabio. Welcome. Jonathan. Thanks, Jonathan. And James Dewig. At the So Far So Good level, we have Shaky T. I'll roll on here. He gets Electronic Warfare Stroke Signals. Use it as you must. Also on here is Nick Edwards, who was our guest last time. Hello there, Nick. And you get Services, open brackets, General, close brackets. Next on the list is Owen Brett Carroll. Here we go, Owen. You get Transport Stroke Assault Helicopter. Next here is Rick Payne. And Rick, you get a motorized anti-tank. Also, we've got Dave Marlowe. You get Airborne Air Defense. Also on here is Steph Xerox. And he gets Target Acquisition. And Daniel Rayner, he gets Self-Propelled Artillery. Upgrading their contribution is Tormad Solberg. Thanks, Tormad. And he's got one of those high back chairs. He's gone to that level. You know, with the wings at the side, like a Parker gnome. Here we go. Let's go. And he's got Armoured Reconnaissance. Open brackets, wheeled, close brackets. Now, if I've messed up your name or I've missed you out, then let me know. Or even if you're somebody who's been supporting us for a while and not had any recognition for a bit, get in touch like Dave Patterson, because Dave Patterson would like another gift, so let's give him a roll. And he gets Chemical Warfare. My goodness. There's a Dirk's dossier coming out for exclusively for patrons over the next couple of weeks. And we'll have another Grog Pod coming to you soon. Until then, adios, amigos.